The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 29th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, from Mother Jones Magazine, Adam Serwer on the potential disaster for Obamacare at the state, at the Supreme Court of the United States, and even more than that, the disaster that is the Supreme Court of the United States. Also on the program, News Corps. We don't just hack voicemails, apparently. Tim DeChristopher, the environmental protester and activist, imprisoned for 3 years because essentially a harmless prank was put in solitary, now just released. We'll have more on that. Of course, new video in the Trayvon Martin case seems to contradict the shooter Zimmerman's claim that he was beaten to the point of feeling he was about to be killed. And Occupy Wall Street, active in the run-up to May 1st, let's get to that story first. As you may or may not be aware, as we speak, there is a general strike going on, a union general strike in Spain. Thursday, today, of course, 6 hours ahead of us. Spain's first general strike since the popular party of Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy came to power last year was started. The strike was called by Spain's two main trade unions to protest a recent overhaul of labor rules that makes it cheaper for employers to hire and fire workers. Why is this relevant? Because we know that Occupy Wall Street has been slowly and increasingly spreading the word that May 1st will be your opportunity to take a couple of days off and reflect upon how effed up our country is. And to that end, a group calling itself the Rank and File Initiative claimed credit yesterday for opening up more than 20 subway stations in New York City for free entry for commuters. They chained open the emergency gates at stations on the FLRQ 3 and 6 lines during rush hour yesterday morning. If you're not from New York City, if you're not familiar with the way our subway system works, there are turnstiles where you take your little Metro card and swipe it through. And always to the left or right of these turnstiles, there is an emergency door that's used if you've got a stroller or a bicycle. And if you're coming out of the subway, you can open them up. A small alarm goes off for a brief period of time. And apparently, teams, 20 teams of three or four people, chained open these gates with the help, supposedly, according to anonymous Occupy Wall Street organizers, by rank-and-file members of the Transit Workers Union Local 100. They are currently in negotiations with the MTA, which is the entity which runs the subways. And they put out a release citing that Albany has, and by Albany, we're, of course, we're talking about the state government, the seat of the state government in New York State, has been chronically underfunding public transportation, which incidentally more and more people are using in this city to the benefit of, well, just about everyone, from making our air better to breathe, making New York City a more livable place, making New York City more accessible to people who can't afford to live in Manhattan, which is just about, well, everybody. And the release cites the fact that Albany has been consistently underfunding public transportation, which forces the MTA to borrow heavily to maintain its operating budget. And this debt must be serviced in part with transit fares that have gone up over 50% over the last decade. And according to the release, quote, this means Wall Street bondholders receive a huge share of what we put into the system through the Metro cards we buy and the taxes we pay. More than $2 billion a year goes to debt service, and this number is expected to rise every year. So rather than raise taxes on the rich in this state, what they do is simply borrow money from the rich so that the rich can then get interest payments that come out of our tax dollars. It's a wonderful system if you're one of these financiers. Not so much if you are a taxpayer or if you're a subway goer. According to a piece in the Village Voice by Nick Pinto, who spoke to one of the organizers, they said, we've been planning this for months. Occupy people, other activists, and union members, the source said. Union members were central to the planning. They told us the best places to go. They talked to their colleagues about what was going to happen and not to be freaked out when we came in. They gave the final green light for the mission this morning. Now, the union itself, the Transportation Union Local 100 leadership, denied knowledge of the action. And the rank and file initiative source, according to this piece, confirmed that they were not notified. Remember, if the union was to be officially involved in this, this would have violated both the Taylor Law and the Taft-Hartley Act. The source claims that there are a lot of angry and afraid union members who wish they could do more, but they're held back by their leadership. There has long been a rift between the local transit workers union and their leadership. And so this is just part of it. Now, this strategy has been used in the past. San Francisco saw a fare strike in 2005. The Spanish Los Indignados have been involved in this, called through a action they call Yo No Pago, which I believe means I no pay. The group also plans to release how-to guides to help anyone else who might want to stage a fare strike in New York subways. They put up signs that look like official MTA signs saying, free fare today. Don't forget, May 1st, general strike day. So May 1st is coming. The American spring will soon perhaps spring in and of itself. We got to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to Adam Serwer of Mother Jones magazine.
Feelings of you made me.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You can get, not only can you get audiobooks, but if you're a listener of the Majority Report, you can get one free. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook download. This is what I would do if I were you. I would go, I would pick up Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States from 1492 to present. If you haven't read it or heard it, go get that one for free. There's others you can get for free too at audiblepodcast.com/majority report.
You hit me like a ton.
We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Adam Serwer, writer for Mother Jones Magazine, has been following the Affordable Care Act in front of the during the oral arguments. You've been in the courtroom for, as far as I know, the past 3 days. Is that right?
Yep.
Not terribly impressed was the sense I got from you as to the work of the Solicitor General representing the administration and, frankly, the country in many respects, in his oral arguments to the Supreme Court. I'm speaking about Donald B. Varelli. That, of course, is just part of the story, but let's start there. Specifically,
well, I thought.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I thought Varelli wasn't very prepared for the obvious question that was going to be asked, which was, you know, if the government can tax you to buy health insurance, what can it do? He didn't have a quick and simple answer, and everyone was sort of speculating as to what this answer, as to how the administration was going to answer this question, and it's almost like he walked into the world's most obvious pop quiz, knowing what the question was going to be, and didn't know what to say. And I think that was sort of the worst part of it. He also was sort of gave us.
All right, well, hold on for 1 second. Let's back up so that we can sort of allow everybody to catch up with us.
Sure.
We're talking about the oral arguments as to the constitutionality of the mandate. Now, as hopefully people know by now, the mandate is essentially a fine that would be levied if you chose. To not buy health insurance, and we're talking about 2% of the American population that would not be subsidized, that would not end up on Medicaid. We're talking about 2% of the American population that would make the active choice not to buy health insurance. The government would tax you, essentially. Now, unlike other taxes, the IRS does not have the authority to place a lien on you, really does not have the ability to do anything other than say, you really should pay this. And so the question before the court, or the central question you're talking about, is what is the limiting principle? Why is it that the administration would argue that the government has the the ability under the Commerce Clause to compel the purchase of this product? Where would that ability end? That is the limiting principle, and that's what you're talking about, that Varelli didn't seem to have a clear answer for.
Right, and it's definitely not an easy question in terms of the mandate. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, it's easy to go up there and defend the mandate in front of the Supreme Court, especially since it's worth noting that Varelli had a much more hostile audience than Clement did, because there are five Republican-appointed justices on the court, and those five justices tend to be more animated towards the attorneys making arguments, and the liberal justices tend to be. But it was, I think, for supporters of the law, pretty disappointing to watch.
So let's talk about this, because I want to talk specifically about this limiting principle. And when you reference Clement, you're talking about the plaintiff's attorney who's representing the 20-some-odd states who are fighting this mandate, particularly
that
Florida,
is correct.
I guess. And so this limiting principle, the thing that keeps coming up is, I know as a responsible journalist, you can't say this, but I can. Personalities of some of those Supreme Court justices on the right, specifically a guy like Scalia, tend to be sort of dickish. And so they are far more aggressive in their questioning in many respects. But let's get to also their sort of their qualities as jurists, but a little bit later. So let's talk about this is a very difficult question. But of course, we're talking about theoretically the most important litigator in the country in this respect. And he's probably been working on this for the better part of a year, I would imagine, to answer this one question, which essentially is if the government can compel somebody to buy health insurance, why can't they compel them to buy broccoli?
The broccoli question is really easy, and I was sort of shocked that Verrilli didn't respond to that forcefully, because the broccoli question is sort of – this is like a sort of, you know, free republic commenter question. Justice Alito and Justice Roberts asked much harder questions, which was what about mandating cell phones so that people can call the cops, or what about burial insurance because everyone dies? Those are slightly harder. But the broccoli question is really an easy one, because health insurance doesn't work like broccoli. You can tax people for not buying broccoli and make them buy broccoli that way, but you can make people buy all the broccoli in the world and it's not actually going to make them healthier, because you can't make them eat it. Whereas with health insurance, you deal with the problems of having a health insurance market by having everyone have health insurance, and then sick people, you don't have the problem of sick people driving up premiums. Like, I was sort of shocked that Verrilli didn't have a ready answer for that. And particularly that, and maybe he was thrown off by Scalia, who was pretty hostile in terms of his questioning. And the funny thing is that Scalia is the author of one of the legal precedents that the administration assumed would make it very hard to strike down the Affordable Care Act.
This is Rausch.
Right, this is Raich. So Raich. Scalia, basically, in that case, ruled that the Commerce Clause could be used to justify drug prohibition in a case where someone was growing medicinal marijuana for their own personal use. Now, think about that. The argument from conservatives is that, the mandate is unprecedented because it regulates economic inactivity. But the person in Raich was not trying to, quote-unquote, enter the stream of commerce. He was growing marijuana for his own personal medicinal use. And yet Justice Scalia still argued that the federal government could regulate it under the Commerce Clause because it had a substantial impact on interstate commerce. I mean, it's a ridiculous idea to think you can regulate non-economic activity but not economic inactivity. That's a really dumb distinction. But once again, I mean, I think, Verrilli had a much more hostile court to face, and Clement was received by a much more sympathetic court. Even the liberal justices who challenged Clement didn't do so in the same sort of tone that Verrilli was spoken to.
All right. Well, let's not pick on Verrilli here. Let's wade through some of these issues. So,
all right, so
let's talk about cell phone use, and let's talk about burial insurance, and let's talk about the sort of the difficulty, but maybe not so much the difficulty in this concept of a limiting principle, because this is what theoretically. And in my estimation, I don't know, and I say theoretically because I have a take on the Supreme Court that they may be sort of completely immune or inoculated from any type of reasoning that would force them to do something. But for the moment, let's play along. How is it different, this idea that that because your decision to not buy health insurance necessarily implicates the rest of this 1/6 of the economy that is healthcare. How is that different from a cell phone usage or burial insurance?
Well, I mean, first of all, so burial insurance, everyone dies, right? But you only die once. The fact of you don't get more dead and then drive up the cost for other dead people who are dying. Like, it's just not an accurate analogy. And Roberts' analogy didn't work either because, you know, emergency services in the United States isn't a market. It's not like taxing people if they don't buy cell phones would actually facilitate access to emergency services. Even it's just a very flawed analogy. But there are better analogies than the broccoli analogy. I think the issue that should have been hammered home, at least I thought, was that the health insurance market is extremely unique. There's really nothing else like it. And Verrilli did try to do that, but it was sort of indicative of how poorly the arguments went, was that the first person to really clearly articulate that was Justice Ginsburg in the context of sort of rescuing Verrilli from, you know, a moment where he seemed to be stumbling.
And what did he say?
Well, I mean, he wasn't actually, she was talking, she said, I thought, you know, it was interrupting an exchange she was having with another justice, and she said, well, I thought that what was unique about the health insurance market is that we all need health insurance at one point, because we all need health care at some point. And this is, to an extent, the limiting principle that people have been talking about all along, which is that the uniqueness of the health insurance market and the uniqueness of healthcare as an issue make it so that this really couldn't be applied to anything else. No matter all the examples that people come up with, you know, a mandate for electric cars, I think in one piece I used the hypothetical Microsoft Zune mandate. There's nothing that really works like the health insurance market, so there's no other place in which a regulation like this would be justified. But in a larger sense, there's a Yale law professor named Jack Balkin, who wrote sort of a piece after Verrilli's arguments, who laid out three limiting principles. And the strongest one, I think, is that, you know, the truth is that we have limits on what kind of taxes we can levy. But we manipulate people through the tax code all the time in terms of what we tax them to buy or not to buy. We the government is constantly trying to control people's behavior. Both parties do it. You know, conservatives want people to get tax breaks for getting married. They want, you know, everybody is tries to manipulate social behavior through
the mortgage deduction, deductions for health care is one example, but
sure.
Capital gains in and of itself, the fact that it's treated differently, is also theoretically something to incent people to do something with their money.
And what was interesting was that during the arguments, Justice Sotomayor was talking to Michael Carvin, who is one of the attorneys arguing against the constitutionality of the mandate, and she said, so from your point of view, it would be constitutional for the government to just tax everyone and set up a public health insurance system. And he said, well, yeah, that would be fine, but you can't tax. I mean, and so Justice Kennedy actually at a different point in the argument said, well, I don't know if it's better to say, you know, the government should be more honest and just tax people and set up a public health insurance system, or whether, since that's kind of what the government is doing in a really roundabout way, that makes this constitutional. He was just sort of thinking out loud. But it really is sort of like this question the mandate is in some ways unprecedented, but in other ways it's not unprecedented at all.
But isn't it also unprecedented in the sense that, the whole point of this is that we, undergirding this notion, is that we believe that everyone should have access to health care, and that we have a market that is broken. I mean, that's the fundamental premise here, right? That the insurance market is broken, and we see it's broken in two different ways. One way in that there are literally people who cannot get insurance. They cannot afford it, and or there is no product available to them because they have pre-existing conditions. So the government is in a position of trying to make it possible for those people with pre-existing conditions, say, to be able to get insurance. And this is there's only two paths to doing that. One is for the government to offer it to everyone or through a single payer system, which is what hilarity, if you will, of the conservative justices suggesting that maybe that has no constitutional problems, or to essentially force everyone to make an active decision beforehand to buy health insurance rather than to sort of pass that cost off as an externality to the rest of us.
Right. I mean, the idea here is that we're all paying one way or the other. And I think part of the problem is, and I think this is really sort of, there is at this point a sort of philosophical divide between liberals and conservatives, which is that conservatives don't really think that making sure everyone has health care is like a worthy policy goal. And so it doesn't actually matter. The means to getting there doesn't actually matter. There was a time, I think, where there was like a little more agreement about this. But when you look at the second thing that the other part of the law that they were challenging was the Medicaid expansion. And what they were arguing was that the Medicaid expansion, which is a huge part of the Affordable Care Act, it extends health insurance, it gives access to health care for 16 million people, which is half of the 32 million who are going to get health care under the act if it stands. And they were saying that it's coercive because, you know, they either have to take the federal government paying for 90% of what it's going to cost to cover these new people, or they lose all their Medicaid funds. And so their argument was that this is really mean, and you're forcing the states into it. Well, that's not really true. The truth is that the states don't want to give up Medicaid because Medicaid is really popular. But you know, these Republicans also don't really want to allow the act to work, and they don't want to cover these other people. So I mean, there really is a big first principles issue here, I think, which is that the conservative movement at this point in time does not see universal health insurance coverage as like something to aspire to. Whereas, you know, it's pretty much as far as the left is concerned, I think it's the most important, or at least until the act passed, it was sort of the big goal other than dealing with climate change.
All right. So so for those, you know, just in terms of this Medicare, this was one of the sort of the strangest aspects of this case.
Medicaid.
Because essentially, you know, we have pre-existing and I just want to slow it down so that people can catch up here. Medicaid, of course, is a program that the federal government provides funds to states to administer Medicaid, which provides health insurance essentially for people who don't have the money to pay for it. They have exhausted their funds either through Medicare or they're simply at the poverty line.
We're talking mostly in large part children and old people. For the most part. Also people with disabilities, but sorry, go on.
And this expands Medicaid to 133% of poverty. And so it basically subsidizes, pays for the health insurance and therefore the access to health care for 13 million more people. And the states are arguing, even though that they have a very minute burden in terms of adding to the cost of this, that you're expanding this and you're saying that if we don't accept the expansion, that we'll get none of our Medicaid and we don't want to do it. It's just a bizarre argument because theoretically they could do it retroactively with the size of Medicaid as it stands now. Right. I mean, couldn't they?
Right.
Say,
I mean, that's the argument is like you could actually. I mean, one of the justices said is like, doesn't that mean Medicaid is already unconstitutional? Because it's not like previous expansions of Medicaid haven't also been similarly mandatory in terms of whether or not you get all the funds.
Right. I mean, a state could theoretically say, like, we actually want our Medicaid program to be 75%, 25% less in terms of size than it is now, and so we're being coerced to maintain it at 100%.
Yeah, I mean it's really sort of a weird argument, and if the Supreme Court accepts it, I mean the Medicaid thing is actually almost more important than the mandate, because conceivably, you know, there are alternatives to the mandate that if the mandate alone was struck down and Obama won re-election, there's a hypothetical scenario where Congress fixes the Affordable Care Act with a different mechanism that works, that isn't the mandate, but that, it, you know, works in a similar way in terms of solving the problems that the mandate was meant to solve. But if the Medicaid expansion is ruled unconstitutional, that has implications for not just Medicaid, which is really obviously really important for people on the low end of the economic spectrum, but it has implications for how the federal government, spends its money in the states in general. It's a really big deal.
Now, give me your sense of clearly, at least your sense was rather skeptical in terms of whether or not the mandate will survive. Give me your sense of what the how the oral arguments went in terms of its severability from the entire act. Now, the weird thing in this situation is that the government and, in this case, I guess the defendant and the plaintiffs are both arguing that the mandate cannot be severed from the rest of the Affordable Care Act. And am I right in this, that the court actually had to appoint an amici? Go ahead.
Sorry, the conservatives on the court were arguing the mandate is the heart of the Affordable Care Act. Therefore, if you tear out the heart, you have to get rid of the whole thing. The government was arguing that if you get rid of the mandate, you also have to get rid of the ban on discriminating on the basis of pre-existing conditions, because otherwise you'd ban the you'd bankrupt the insurance companies. There was an amici who was appointed by the court. Sorry, there was a third lawyer who was making the argument that you can just strike down the mandate, and you can keep all the stuff that everybody, you know, really likes about the healthcare bill. And he was, and I thought he actually made a really good argument. But it's the administration is sort of in this awkward place of begging the court, you know, if you strike down the mandate, please, you know, save the insurance companies.
Right. And so and this is sort of also a bizarre argument, because there is no question as to whether or not the federal government has the ability to regulate insurance companies. In other words, if there was just a bill, and we, you know, let's not deal with the political realities for a moment, but if there was an act that was passed that simply said you cannot discriminate against people based upon pre-existing conditions, you cannot provide lifetime caps on their health insurance or yearly caps on their health insurance, you have to offer free preventative care, all of these aspects of the Affordable Care Act that are things that I think are rather uncontroversial, at least in terms of what people want. The federal government has the authority, and no one's challenging whether or not they have that authority under the Commerce Clause.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's really. I think that was made clear during arguments. They're not challenging the constitutionality of that other stuff. They're just saying it has to go if the mandate goes. And the administration was saying that if the mandate has to go, this the guaranteed issue, which is the non-discrimination on the basis, that has to go as well. It's really. I actually thought that the attorney who is arguing that the mandate should be severed, if they get rid of the mandate, it should be severed from the law on its own and not take away anything else. I think he actually had the strongest or the clearest argument to make, because
what was his argument?
Well, his argument was that you can take the mandate out and the bill will still, for the most part, work as intended, and that it would not be respectful of Congress's intent to think that the mandate is the only thing in the bill that they really meant to pass, and if you take this out, then it should, you should really take out all the other good things. You should remove all the other good things that this bill does. Of course, for the conservatives on the court who want to see the law gone, that's a feature, not a bug.
Right. Well, but let me ask you this. I mean, from a legal standpoint, I mean, is it really the job of the Supreme Court? Now, it's increasingly clear, and it's been that way for me since 2000, that the Supreme Court seizes its job, whatever they want to do. But is it really their job to sort of determine as to whether or not the law is a good idea, or that the implications for the insurance companies is relevant in their determination as to whether or not one aspect or all aspects of the bill are constitutional?
Right. I mean, that's why I think the third attorney had the strongest argument. I think the two arguments that make the most sense are get rid of the whole bill or remove the part of the bill that is supposedly offending and unconstitutional. I think those are the two most consistent arguments. I thought the administration was sort of walking a really fine line.
I mean, it also seems to me that if one accepts that the federal government has the right, the ability, the constitutional ability to regulate the health insurance industry, and one then says, I mean, this is in terms of striking down the whole bill, then one says, well, that can't be done without the mandate. So they are almost, they're not severable. Doesn't that sort of also sort of imply that the mandate is therefore constitutional? Because if I have a right as the government, constitutionally speaking, to do A, but I need B to successfully do A, how can then you tell me that B is unconstitutional?
Right. So this is an argument that the government made, which is that it's a necessary and proper part of a comprehensive scheme of regulation. And like that's such a mouthful that I think while it may be like it may have legal merit, it doesn't really have the same impact as the government can't make you buy something. I mean, it's just rhetorically.
Well, I understand that politically, but theoretically, all these guys went to law school, right? I mean,
well, yeah, but. I mean, the justices on the court are political actors, and there's this way in which the court is sometimes talked about by some legal elites as not being immune from politics, but to a certain extent being above it when it counts. And I just think that's obviously not true. And it was pretty clear during oral arguments when Republicans started, you know, talking about Senate horse trading and stuff like that, things that were, you know, real bugaboos for Fox News, but they didn't really belong in a Supreme Court argument.
All right. Well, this takes us to the area that I'm actually even more interested in talking about, because as a law school dropout and someone who ended up taking about 700 photographs of my TV during the deliberations of the Bush v. Gore, do you think, I mean, because, you know, there was a lot of people in the legal and left-leaning establishment who thought it was impossible for the Supreme Court to strike this down because of what you're talking about. The legal elite in this country, and I think it expands beyond that, have perceived the Supreme Court to be above the sort of rank political motives, that they don't have a political agenda. And one of the most frustrating things for me in the wake of Bush v. Gore was the sort of seeming, I think the legal establishment was in sort of a state of shock, and things may have been very different had 9/11 not happened. On September 13th of 2001, the Newsweek was going to put on its cover about the rift on the Supreme Court that had been sort of ripped open over the past the 9 months preceding that case, and it obviously never happened. That pushback on the court never happened. Do you think that in the event they strike this down, that that's going to change? Because on the left, it seems to me there has been a complete deference to the independence of the Supreme Court, and almost a fiction that has gone along with that, that these people are beyond partisan politics, even though they essentially selected the president in 2000. Do you think that's going to change?
I have no idea. I mean, you know, the entire conservative legal movement, which is incredibly successful, despite the fact that conservatives sort of talk about the law in this way that it can be objectively evaluated and there's always one right answer, the entire conservative legal movement is premised on the idea that ideology and politics matter more than the law. I mean, that's what their opinion of Roe is, that it's ideological, it's not the right interpretation of the law, and they've spent the past 50 years trying to put their people in federal courts and trying to put quote unquote real conservatives on the Supreme Court, and that and that's paid off. But there's nothing resembling that on the left. There's absolutely no similar sort of movement for transforming the courts in the same way. And you can see this in the way that the administration itself has dealt with Senate obstruction of its federal court nominees, which is, you know, not very well. I mean, the federal courts are empty. There are all these vacancies, and the administration really hasn't been pounding its fist the way the Bush administration did. So, I mean, you remember the phrase up or down vote, up or down vote? I mean, we heard that over and over again during the Bush administration when they were trying to get their judges confirmed. And they didn't get all the ones confirmed that they wanted to get confirmed, But Bush got his judges confirmed at a much higher rate than Obama has been. And the result of this is going to be that even before laws get to the Supreme Court, the lower courts are going to be making decisions that, you know, the left is really going to hate. And there's not, you know, because they're not doing anything about it now, there's not going to be anything to do about it then.
Well, why do you think there's this failure, Adam? I mean, that's what I'm getting to, is that what is in the psyche of the establishment, the center left, liberals? I mean, I can tell you that I'm quite sure that my audience is far less attuned and interested in the Supreme Court, in circuit, in courts, in appellate court judgeships, than the right is. The right has sort of figured this out, and they cloaked it with this notion of original intent or literalism or whatever they wanted to say, which was essentially a fig leaf for the Constitution. You can't interpret the Constitution. The Constitution is what it says, or basically what we think it says.
Well, I think that part of it is that Bush v. Gore was kind of a reversible one moment thing, right? So Bush v. Gore got Bush president, made Bush president, so to speak, or stopped the recount in Florida. But the left could elect a new president. You know what I mean? Like after Bush, Barack Obama got elected, so that was correctable in a way that I think, you know, abortion is not, and as a result, this animating force behind the conservative legal movement has been much more self-perpetuating in a way that Bush v. Gore has not. I mean, Bush v. Gore made it clear that the court was a partisan institution, but
do you think it did, though?
It's not like a permanent sustaining thing that they are constantly fighting and therefore are reminded of, you know, what their goal is, which is to, you know, permanently end a woman's ability to decide when she carries a pregnancy to term.
Do you think that Bush v. Gore made that distinction clear, that it's a partisan institution? I mean, maybe to you and maybe to I, but to the people that mattered. In other words, you know, when we heard from so many quarters, particularly legal ones, but also, you know, sort of establishment policy people, that there's no way this Supreme Court will find this unconstitutional. And they haven't yet, I mean, to be fair. But do you really think that idea that the Supreme Court is a partisan institution actually was adopted by those people? Because if it was, then what they were engaging in was an incredible amount of malpractice.
Well, I mean, I think that the public views the court as largely partisan. I mean, like, if you look at, you know, Kaiser Family Foundation did polls, and 60% of people thought that the mandate decision would the judges would let their own ideological views influence the decision. Only 28%, a little more than a quarter, thought it would be based on legal analysis. And, you know, just in general, 75% of people polled thought that the Supreme Court makes decisions based on ideology. So, I mean, like, there's – I think people do view the Supreme Court, you know, the public at least, in a broad sense, does see the Supreme Court as, like, a political institution, even if the judges in their self-regard have convinced themselves that that's not the case.
You know, it's interesting because I interviewed Darren Acemoglu, who just wrote this book, Why Nations Fail, for an interview that we're going to play in the coming weeks. But he cited, you know, his premise is the idea of inclusive institutions is what made this country succeed economically. He cited FDR's threatening to pack the Supreme Court as an example of a very dangerous attempt to change the inclusive nature of these institutions. I see that sort of to the opposite, because in some respects, what we're seeing now is that you have an institution with the Supreme Court that I think is evidenced by Bush v. Gore, and potentially evidenced by this, that they can basically do whatever they want, and they are anything but inclusive. They are anything other, you know, they do not feel any type of incentive to have their institution be inclusive in the sense that they need to sort of embrace a broader notion of its importance to the country as a whole, as opposed to furthering a narrow, or maybe they could argue 40 or 50% agenda, and a rather radical one. Do you think that in the event that this the mandate is struck down, or that the entire law is struck down, that there's going to be a change in that perspective as to what becomes appropriate response to the Supreme Court by those people who were not perhaps moved by Bush v. Gore?
I don't know. I mean, I think it at least temporarily that might be the case. But I wonder, you know, I wonder if it'll have the same impact as Roe v. Wade did on the conservative movement. I suspect not. I think that, you know, I do think that what you're describing is sort of like how conservatives felt when those mean old liberals on the court were doing things like, you know, integrating schools and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That the court just didn't care, was just doing whatever it wanted to do with no regard for legitimacy or anything like that. But I do think that. I do think that the Supreme Court striking down the law in its entirety, maybe even going as far as undermining Medicaid, I do think that would have a significant political impact. But I don't know if it would be the same. It would have the same impact on sort of the liberal view of the courts. I mean, I think someone suggested to me the other day that the biggest impact would be that liberals would suddenly sort of rally around the idea of mobilizing towards achieving a single payer health care system. And I think that's probably right in terms of what the impact would be. I'm not sure that people would – I'm still not sure that that would focus liberals' attention on the courts as much as Roe focused conservative attention on the courts.
Do you think there was a failure by the Obama administration to really sort of sell the Affordable Care Act after the fact, which would – you know, it wouldn't necessarily – it might have – you know – have had some impact on the Supreme Court, assuming they have any, you know, assuming maybe Kennedy, you know, reads the papers and has a notion that it would be more difficult for him to get away with striking this down. But in terms of a political response, do you think that that was a failure on the Obama administration's part?
I mean, look, I can't. I don't know if that's the case. What I can say is that this was always going to be an uphill battle because there are five Republican appointees on the court and there are four Democratic appointees on the court, and the court is a partisan institution. And you know, no matter. I mean, the fact is that at oral arguments, the conservative attorney Paul Clement was much more impressive than the Solicitor General Donald Verrilli. But even if Verrilli had been, you know, Thurgood Marshall, it wouldn't have mattered because there are five GOP-appointed justices on the court and there are four Democratic justices on the court. And that factor, more than anything else, I think it is the most important determinant of how this is going to turn out. Now, I don't know how it's going to turn out. Kennedy left hints that he might uphold the law. He seemed to be leaning against it, but we really don't know. There's really no way to know how this is going to pan out.
So even if I dangle a Majority Report mug in front of you, you will not make any hard, fast predictions?
No, I absolutely won't, because you never know. I mean, Kennedy is pretty unpredictable. That's why conservatives hate him, even though he's, like, by any objective measure, a conservative judge. But he you never know what he's going to decide, and I wouldn't presume to be able to read his mind here.
A mug and a legacy.
Although I would love the
majority
report. I would love the mug. Don't think I'm not.
A mug and a legacy majority report mouse pad. Would that do it?
I'm incredibly tempted by the mug. I can't tell you I love mugs, but I won't make a prediction. I have no idea. It didn't look good in oral arguments, but you know, there's no way to know.
All right. Well, we may just send you the mug anyways as a token of our appreciation.
Thank you very much.
All right, Adam Serwer of Mother Jones Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Take care,
folks. That is the lesser half of our show. Please become a member. Are you going to get this from any other show? This level of talk. Now, I know this level of depth of conversation caters only to a very exclusive, high class, mostly intelligent group of people. But folks, this stuff doesn't grow on trees. You can't go out and there's no podcast tree. There's no smart interview tree out there. We don't grow this in a little planter inside the Majority Report juggernaut offices. No, it takes your support. Don't even think about it as membership if you don't want to. I think yesterday we had 3 cancellations, moved to hardship, and as far as I know, we had no new members. So we need your support, folks. It is far cheaper than going out and growing your own smart, interesting, sometimes entertaining podcast tree. And then waiting, I don't know how long it takes before that bears fruit. 10, 15 years? 20 years? Maybe never.
If someone does invent that, you owe us some sort of percentage of the money because you obviously got the idea from us.
There you go. Listen to Matt. He's horribly sick, but he still comes into work because otherwise the thing wouldn't happen.
I'm here for all of you.
Majority.fm, please, we need your support to continue this program. You can also check out justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, organic, fair trade. Use our Amazon link at majority.fm, support the show. You'll find it there. Anything you buy, we get a little tiny kickback. That helps, but it's really your membership that we need. We'll take your iTunes reviews. We'll take your donate your account.com. But it's your membership that we need. All right, folks, you can join me in the better half. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. I'm turning on my IM machine. See you in the better half. Got plenty.